the Ulster Unionist Party, and Doug Beattie is here this morning. First of all, Doug, thank you very much for coming in.
No, it's a pleasure, Stephen.
And your leader, Steve Aiken, said to me that he feels it's in the interest of democracy that political parties make themselves accountable to programmes like this.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate you coming in this morning. Let's start with health.
Yeah.
And in your manifesto, you've said that you want to declare a health emergency in Northern Ireland. What would that mean?
Well, first of all, Stephen, I have to say we have a health emergency in Northern Ireland, and we've been moving towards a health emergency for a certain number of years now. And I should not be sitting here as a political representative of a major political party and not say part of that blame lies with me and lies with my party. All politicians are responsible. And I think it's important that nobody tries to say that they are not guilty in some form or another. But the reality is decisions are not being made. Decisions need to be made. They should have been made 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and they're not. So a medical emergency means that we need to transfer the powers back to Westminster so that decisions can be made. Now, that won't fix the problem.
The powers are already in Westminster right now.
Well, they're not the devolved powers aren't in Westminster.
Yeah, but we don't have a devolved government, so Julian Smith has the power.
Well, he has the power, so he should be using that power. And again, I've got to say, I'm not passing the buck to Julian Smith, but the reality is, as our Secretary of State, he needs to do something, and we're saying that he should transfer health back to Westminster to a direct rule minister in order to make decisions. Now, making decisions will not fix the problem. I know it will not fix the problem, but we can't just sit here and wait. How long do we wait? We've already waited 3 years. We had people dying on waiting lists in 2016. That has got worse now. Today, the situation is absolutely intolerable. So somebody has to start making decisions and start the process of fixing it.
So when the Ulster Unionist Party say in your manifesto a healthcare emergency to be declared in Northern Ireland, what you're actually saying is we can't solve it in Northern Ireland, pass it over to the English to solve.
Right.
Is that not an indictment on politics here, Doug?
It absolutely is, and that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what the party is saying. Is right at this moment in time, we are not fixing this issue that we've got, and it's getting worse, and it's got worse over the last 2 years and even longer than that. So we're saying that we can't at this moment in time fix it. So we need to do something to try and take decisions. We cannot have our clinical and non-clinical staff standing there with unequal pay, with such gaps in our health service, again at non-clinical and clinical positions, in the manner that we have now. We have to do something about it, and decisions have to be made. And it's okay saying, well, we'll have talks on the 16th of December, and if we don't have a resolution by the 13th of January, then we're going to go into an election. Then we go into an election for what? For another 6 weeks of politicians knocking your door and saying how great we are, while our waiting lists get even longer? It's not acceptable. If this was North Yorkshire, which is the Secretary of State's constituency, there would have been an emergency declared already, and they would have been taking action.
But I doubt if it was North Yorkshire, the Secretary of State or anybody else in England would be saying, please give it to a Northern Irish politician to sort.
No,
you're a Northern Irish party,
yeah,
saying, we can't handle this, please get the English in. For goodness sake, why do you want to be part of a devolved administration here if you can't be part of the solution?
Yeah, well, we can all be part of the solution, Stephen. And if the executive and Stormont was up and running tomorrow, then we would be able to start taking decisions. The point that I'm making is this. If it's not up and running tomorrow, how long do we wait? Do we wait another 2 months, 6 months, another year? How long do we have to wait before decisions start to be made? That's the point that we're making here. We believe we've well gone over that tipping point. We've fallen off the end of the cliff. Those decisions, we believe, need to be made now. Those decisions on workforce planning, those decisions on pay, and how do we tackle waiting lists? Where do we get the extra funding from in order to deal with this? All of those decisions have to be made now so we can start the long road of recovery in our health service.
But if there was a Stormont restored in Northern Ireland, would the Ulster Unionist Party want a Northern Irish politician as a health minister here in our devolved institution?
Yes, we would. I mean, what I'm talking about here, Stephen, and what the Ulster Unionist Party is talking about right now is we do not believe that in the short term to medium term, that there's any chance of the Assembly coming up here. So we have a real concern that we could be sitting in the same position in 6 months' time or a year's time. So what we're saying is action now, and that is a devolved health minister now. If the executive was set up tomorrow, we would have a Northern Irish health minister. That's devolved government.
Would you want the ministry?
Well, the Ulster Unionist Party, well, absolutely. If we were in
that
the...
That would be your first choice, would it?
Well, if we were in the executive, I would like to think that we think health is such an important thing that if we had a first choice, that we would be choosing the health ministry. Now, some people would see that as a poison chalice because, you know, there's always bad stories coming out, but we don't see it like that. We see it absolutely the opposite, and that is health is one of the most important things here in Northern Ireland. So, of course, we would take it, and of course we would take it as a first choice.
Well, would we want you to take it? Because part of the problem, if we look at the health service here in Northern Ireland at the moment, Doug, yes, it's about pay. In fact, let's deal with the pay issue straight away. Should there be parity?
Yes. Yes.
Did you argue for it at the time when it was broken?
Well, it was an executive decision at the time, which was 2016. We weren't in the executive, so we didn't have a choice in this. So
did
it was
you come out fighting?
Well, we come out fighting on everything, Stephen. There was lots
of
things. Well, you know, can I throw my mind back to exactly what happened in 2016 between me and you? No, I can't.
But pretty big issue if our health workers weren't getting paid the same. But the Ulster Unionist Party stands side by side with our health workers.
But it wasn't.
The time.
But it wasn't the only issue, Stephen. And remember that. Particular mandate lasted for 9 months only before it all collapsed. So there was many issues that we were fighting for. Do I throw my mind back and say, you know, that's the thing I was standing with the banner out talking about at the time? I can't tell you that because I'm the justice spokesperson. So it may not have been me, but that's not to say people weren't doing that. I just can't give you that answer. So I'm not going to spin and lie to you. I'm just going to tell you. I just can't. I don't know back in 2016. But the reality was the decision was made. Now, I'm not sitting here saying the person who made the decision is a bad person. You know, he had fiscal...
Well, Jim Wells, in the DUP, made the decision, and it was 2014, by the way. It was not 2016, it was 2014.
Well, okay.
Were you not part of the executive then?
No, I wasn't, no. I was just an old lowly councillor.
The Ulster Unionist Party.
Sorry?
The Ulster Unionist Party.
I was in the Ulster Unionist Party, I was a councillor at
the
state.
Was the Ulster Unionist Party not in the executive?
They were, they left the executive in 2015.
Right. So in 2014... when the Ulster Unionist Party were part of the executive, our healthcare staff didn't get the same money as the rest in the UK.
Okay.
Did the Ulster Unionist Party fight that?
In the executive, yes. We had one minister at the time in that executive, and that was Danny Kennedy, and we fought against it. And we did not think it should happen. We foresaw this being the case in the future, and that would be the case that that disparity would lead to an animosity and could grow. And we're not just talking about nurses here. We're talking about porters. We're talking about other non-clinical staff. We're talking about cleaners. I mean, this is dear to us all. I've got family members who work within that environment. So I know exactly where the issues are.
So you would restore parity right now. You're urging Richard Pengelly as the permanent secretary. He's the man currently in charge to do that, are you?
We believe that's the case, yes.
Where would he get the money from?
Well, we laid out in our manifesto where that money comes from.
Richard
Pengelly... Well, the money's here now. The money is there now. The ability to borrow money now to get that £50 million or £60 million that required is there now. We have the ability to borrow that in a low-interest loan over 25 years. So it's there now. The problem is Richard Pengelly doesn't have the authority to borrow it. So he needs to be given that authority to borrow it, or we need a direct rule minister who can do it. So the money can be got right now, today.
So you would borrow that money?
Yes.
And do we borrow it next year and the following year and the following year?
Well, we've suggested, and it's in the manifesto, that we can borrow £200 million from the Reinvestment and Reform Initiative. That's a fund which is designed exactly for things like this, and we pay it back in low interest over 25 years. So if that fixes this particular crisis in the health service, Stephen, then absolutely we think that you should borrow it. But there's another thing here as well, and that is there was a Barnett consequential.
Well, hold on, just before we get on if you don't mind, because borrowing... rightly so, political parties are challenged when there's this simplicity of just borrow money. Because if you borrow too much money in any economy, it wrecks it. People's interest rates go up and it wrecks an economy. Yeah. Now, you would borrow this money, and the borrowing facility, and I don't want to bore people this morning, but I want them to understand, and I've only started to understand this over recent days reading this. So it's called RRI. An RRI is essentially a borrowing facility that was set up in 2002 to support Northern Ireland Executive's Infrastructure Investment Programme. And this allows the executive to borrow up to £200 million per year. This is what you're talking about, okay? And it's used to set spending in Northern Ireland. The Barnett formula is as well as Scotland and Wales. That's the Barnett formula. So the ceiling for this borrowing is £3 billion. The loans are generally repaid, as you said, over a 25-year period. There is interest on that. Do you know what our current borrowing is, Doug? In Northern Ireland?
I don't have that.
I don't expect you to know. £2 billion. Do you know what the cost is? The annual cost in 2012-13 was in excess of £100 million. So this is the estimated costs of RRI repayments. They keep on going up. They will peak at just over £140 million a year. That's what we're paying from Northern Ireland. And you want us to borrow more. So £140 million a year going out on this borrowing that's already happened, and you want us to borrow more.
Well, I would say, Stephen, to you that this particular thing that we're talking about here would be a good debt. This is a good debt to borrow that money for our nurses.
My point is there's
clinical.
A cost to the debt.
No, of course there's cost in the debt. Everybody knows there's cost in the debt. And if you just look at this as a single piece of we're borrowing money without looking at in the round, then you're absolutely right. And it's very easy to say that. You know, and I'm not sitting here and saying this because, look, I want to put Northern Ireland in hock for many, many years to come. We are dealing with an extreme crisis right now where people are dying on waiting lists. I know this, Stephen. Look, I've got personal experience of people dying on waiting lists. So I think it's a good debt to be able to do this, to be able to value our clinical and non-clinical staff, and that will go some way to increasing the gap of people we have within the health service, because we've got a huge gap.
So you would borrow the money to give the health service the pay parity?
Well,
and that would cost how much?
Well, it's about £50 to £60 million to give them that pay parity, and clearly that gets a little bit larger as the workforce regenerates to the levels it's supposed to be at. But Stephen,
I thought your manifesto said you wanted to borrow the money to free up elective care capacity.
It is, Stephen,
and you didn't say to pay the staff.
Listen, please, if I can. So when I'm saying you borrow the money, which can deal with one issue, which frees up money somewhere else, which can then deal with the pay parity issue. I mean, the money comes in and you're ignoring...
No, it doesn't.
But it does.
Okay.
It does.
So your manifesto is saying that you would borrow this money to free up elective care capacity.
Yes.
All right? Fine. But we have got so many people on waiting lists
that
there would be an endless need for that money. So how is there going to ever be any spare cash to give the workers their pay increase that you're also promising?
Right, because and you've stopped me twice in saying this, and if you bear in mind, because this borrowing of the £200 million for that particular issue, which can free up money elsewhere, but as I was going on to say to you, is that £1.2 billion of the Barnett consequential, which is another £200 million every year for 5 years, could be ring-fenced purely for the health service. And we don't know that it is right at this moment in time. And the reason we don't know that it is right at this moment in time is because we do not have sight of the finances and the budget here in Northern Ireland, because we have no executive. So we're saying that that should be ring-fenced. And that ring-fencing of that money can then go towards ensuring that there is pay parity. It needs to be resourced one way or the other.
So you wouldn't borrow to give the workers their pay rise?
No, the borrowing is to free up money from elsewhere. So if you look at it as one big pot, Stephen, to make it simple, if you look at it as one big pot, if you bring money into that one big pot, it allows you to take money out into a different direction. You know, of course, some of this stuff is salami sliced to go to a particular place. What we are saying, and we're saying it quite loudly, is that there needs to be pay parity, that these people need to be valued. We shouldn't have our porters getting paid £16,000 a year while their equivalent in Scotland and England get £18,000 a year. It's simply not right, and we want to fix that. And by fixing that, what we then get a chance to do is fix the gaps within the health service, because we are missing something over 7,000 vacancies within the health service. And that in itself is creating issues.
Well, when we talk about those vacancies within the health service, yeah, again, it was interesting reading. There are currently 1,025 student nursing and midwifery places commissioned at local universities each year. Okay?
Yes.
That's over 1,000. Do you know how many there were in 2010? 769. It's actually gone up most years. It was 769, then 780. To be fair to you, it dropped to 733, then 710. But 2016, up to 801. 2017, 900. 1,000. 2018, 19. 2019, 1,025. It was under Michael McGimsey. It was under an Ulster Unionist Party health minister that there were these lower figures for student and midwifery places.
Yes.
It's actually gone up over the last couple of years.
You're absolutely right, Stephen, but everything's gone up. So everything's gone up. So the waiting list has gone up. So the staff vacancies have gone up. Everything has changed from Michael Bidipsy being the health minister. And we have had to increase to meet the demand as things have changed over the years. But here's the fundamental problem that we still have, Stephen, and it all is a circular argument, is that we do train these extra people, fantastic people who we need to work here in Northern Ireland. But because of the pay and the conditions, many of them go and find work elsewhere. So until we address that, until these people feel valued, until we can hold on to them here in Northern Ireland, we can train extra all the time. But if we don't value them, we're going to lose them. We're going to drain them out to other places where there is better pay and conditions.
You have a part in your manifesto where you said when you come in here, Doug, that you weren't going to criticise other politicians and just simply blame. But there's a part of your manifesto that actually specifically does that. And it says, was the two-year DUP Conservative Party deal a success? And you say in your manifesto, the DUP claim they secured $1.5 billion for our schools, our hospitals, our roads and broadband. And then you go on to talk about what they don't tell you. And you make comparisons.
Yes.
And one of the comparisons that I wanted to ask you about is the following. You say that in 2017, it was promised by the DUP Conservative Party that $100 million per year for 2 years would be given to support the delivery of health service transformation.
Yes.
And then you say in your 2019 comparison, where you're criticising a DUP, you say much of the money was diverted to other areas and the system remains largely untouched. So you're trying to give the impression there that the money was not given to health service transformation. Why?
Well, first of all, Stephen, it would be churlish of me not to say that the DUP has delivered money for Northern Ireland and for Northern Ireland Health and to other places within Northern Ireland, because they absolutely have.
You don't say that in your manifesto. You say in your manifesto what the DUP hasn't told the public.
So I'm on talking to you here, Stephen, and you're asking me and I'm telling you. So I'm saying to you, we're not being churlish. The DUP has delivered, absolutely has delivered. But there's a point here where you have to challenge what they're saying over and over again, you know, because some people will be bought in by some of this that's being said to them. For example, the £1.5 billion that they say they've delivered, 500 million of that was from the Fresh Start Agreement. So that they didn't deliver that. That was money that's been repackaged and sent back out there. You know, so there's a degree of integrity that has to be looked at here. So the point, hang on, Stephen. So the point is, see, when you look at that table, what we're really saying is, have a look at that. There's information. Go out now and challenge that information to see what's right.
Talk about integrity, yes. I'm questioning that table and whether there is absolute integrity in that table.
Yes, absolutely.
Because when you've given the impression about this specific column I'm looking at, where you say 100 million per year for 2 years to support the delivery of health service transformation, and you then give the impression that that money was not spent on health service transformation because you say much of the money was diverted to other areas.
Yes, where it was diverted.
What were the other areas?
Where the pressures are. So everywhere where there's a pressure, that money was being diverted to. So what it
like
was actually.
What?
So whatever they have within the health trusts.
I'll tell you where 45 million of that 200 million was diverted to waiting lists.
Yeah.
So is that really the type
of... Is that transformational?
It is for someone on a waiting list.
Of course it is, Stephen. Of course it is.
But
it's not transformational.
Are you really going to criticise the DUP for taking 45 million over a two-year period of that 200 million, and the Department of Health for doing this, and that money going in to reducing waiting lists? And my point to you is, it doesn't say it in your manifesto that it was diverted to waiting lists.
Yes.
It says it was diverted to other areas.
Well, it was diverted to other areas, but here's the point.
There's a hell of a difference in someone reading that.
Okay, so here's a point. Here's a point. So I could take the very top of that table there, and I could say, do you know what? The DUP have said to you that they have provided £1.5 million as part of the confidence supply agreement, and we could have left it and just said that wasn't true. They didn't. We could have left it. But what we did was we broke it down so people could understand exactly what has actually happened. So we've actually broke it down. We've broke it down so that people can look and take a comparison to let them understand. Now, what's wrong with doing that? It's right and proper to do that.
I think it's right and proper for me to point out to people that might have been given the impression that this money was diverted and you left it vague in your manifesto to other areas, that people might have thought, well, did they squander that money? It was going in the reducing waiting list for people that were sitting on them. The very point you brought up at the very start of this interview.
Yes, but it was money supposedly ring-fenced for health transformation. And it wasn't. It did not go to health transformation.
So was it the wrong call?
No, it doesn't matter if it's the wrong call, because operationally, the health service are running hot. They're working on a yearly budget, so they're running hot. So any money they get, they have to direct it to where it's needed. And I think that would have been the honest thing to say. We are putting this money into the health service for the health service to direct it where they need it. But it did not go to health transformation. It's as simple as that.
Okay, you also say two other areas for health.
Sure.
You say, despite the blatant crisis in waiting times and growing demand for hospital services, between 2017 and 2018-19, the number of hospital beds decreased by 1.2%. That's from 5902 to 5830. You say we need immediate corrective investment to increase the number of acute hospital beds. Where are we getting that money from?
You see, Stephen, you link a bed as a bed on a ward. And that's it.
No, you talk about investment.
Yes, no.
So investment means money.
Stephen, you need to allow me to explain this, please,
that's
if I can. So you're thinking about a bed, and we are saying we need beds. Here's the problem. Here's why we don't have these beds. We don't have these beds because we don't have the staff to help manage these beds and the people who go into these beds. So everything has to be looked at in the round. So where does the investment come from? The investment comes from making sure we have got the right staff to be able to manage the health service. That means making sure that we have that investment which goes into that health service. And we talked about where that money could come from and maybe even extra money that needs to come into the health service.
So would you borrow more for the corrective investment?
Well, you see, we've already explained to you. I mean, I'm not sure who it was, but I think it was one of the CEOs was on either today or yesterday, and they says we're not talking about billions here to fix this. We are talking about a corrective revenue that comes in to be able to sort out some of the problems that we've had. So the money we've talked about from the Barnett consequential, the money that we've talked about that we would borrow, that 200 millions, all of this in one way or another can all be directed in trying to fix that one problem, because it's a staffing problem. Because if we had the staff, we could have the beds.
No, you couldn't.
Yes, we could. Why could we not? Here's one of the problems. If you go onto a ward, Stephen, some of the wards are empty. Some of them have not got beds because they can't put people in the beds because they don't have the staff to look after those people in their beds. You know, and 20% of people who go to A&E, emergency departments, end up needing treatment which requires a bed.
Okay.
Of some description. So one of the issues that we've got here is to be able to fix the issue in regards to beds is okay. We need to make sure we have the staff.
Okay, one last question
sure.
On health. You say in your manifesto, in order to end the injustice of many patients having to wait years to see a consultant on the NHS,
yep.
But only days to see the same consultant if paying privately, we must work with all staff to encourage and persuade them to remain within the health service. So you're talking about consultants here.
Yep.
That has to include paying them fairer wages.
Yep.
Are consultants not paid enough?
Well, here's a reality, Stephen.
You would give a pay rise to consultants?
It's not just about pay rise. It's pay rise and it's conditions and terms and conditions. There's a whole raft.
You talk about fairer wages. Wages means money.
Yes. There's a whole raft of things, and we're not just talking about consultants. We're talking about staff where there's a comparable with a certain staff at a certain level.
But you talk in this part of your manifesto, Doug, you talk about consultants being paid privately and encouraging staff to work within the health service.
Yes.
And you say that has to include paying them fairer wages.
Yes.
So an obvious question for me, in a health service that is stretched, are you seriously suggesting giving consultants, many of whom are on over 100 grand a year already, more money? Is that what this manifesto is saying you would do with our money?
OK, the key word here, Stephen, is a fairer wage, and to make sure they get them. Now, if they get the right wage, if they're getting a good wage, then what we're looking at is making sure that we get them to stay within the health service and not go private, because we need these people. What we can't have... Look, here, let me look at...
So your, would you give them a pay rise or not?
Well, Stephen, I don't know how much each consultant gets in each different area of the health service. I just simply don't know the answer to that. So I would have to look at each one of those and decide whether or not...
Whoever wrote the manifesto, clearly the inference is they're not getting treated fairly, consultants. And that's why you make a link between consultants not getting paid fairly and the fact that patients are having to wait years to see one. Because you talk about the same consultant being paid privately, but they're doing private work in their spare time.
Yeah, I can only say the same thing again, Stephen, because I don't know what every single consultant gets. What is a fair wage for a consultant? I don't know. So what we're saying is that to be able to hold on to these people, to hold on to that talent within the health service, that we need to make sure that they have a fair wage. If they're getting a fair wage, then they shouldn't expect or shouldn't get a pay increase. That's a fair call, but it's also linked into terms and conditions. We have to do something to hold these people within the health service.
Okay, let's move on. And we've spent quite a lot of time, as I told you I would, on health. Yeah. And you say, towards the beginning of your manifesto, you say the attendance and competency of local MPs, this is in Westminster, in Parliament, is especially important as Northern Ireland drifts ever closer towards creeping direct rule as a result of the absurd political veto that Sinn Féin continues to have over the local political structures.
Yes.
And you talk elsewhere in your manifesto about removing a single party veto. You say you would end the disgrace that one single party is allowed to hold a veto over an executive.
Mm.
So how would that work?
If you throw yourself back to 1998, Stephen, to the Belfast Agreement, had clauses in it where if the Assembly collapsed, then you would automatically go to direct rule. That was removed at St Andrews in 2006. And by removing that in St Andrews in 2006, it now allows one party to collapse the executive and there's no consequences to it. And that's a fundamental problem. And we think that we need to amend that so that that can't happen.
But amend it in what way?
You cannot be... here's a ludicrous situation that we've got now. If you look at the two largest parties, and whoever they're going to be in the future or now, the DUP and Sinn Féin, but whoever in the future, if any one of them just says, look, I just can't be bothered anymore, and they say they're walking out of government, the whole thing collapses. So we need reform. And you've heard people talk about this before, and that is making a sustainable government. We need to have a sustainable assembly. We need to have a sustainable executive. But one party can't just collapse it and there's no consequences.
But you also need to have power sharing.
Of course you do.
And so what I'm confused about this is that it doesn't spell out how it would actually work. So let's say, as what happened, Sinn Féin walks out of a future government.
Yes.
Are you seriously saying that that a government could continue without the biggest, by far, nationalist party in Northern Ireland being part of it?
No, I certainly wouldn't want that, Stephen, because I want...
You want to take away the veto have over an executive. Would it work?
Well, I think I explained earlier on, but let me just start off by saying I want representative politics here in Northern Ireland, and people deserve to have a voice. Everybody deserves to have a voice. And just because I don't agree with a political party doesn't mean that they shouldn't have their say. But the point that we're making is right now, to remove that veto, if you were to say to parties, if you collapse the executive, we're going to direct rule. We're not going to leave these people in limbo. That was taken away at St Andrews. So what we're saying is put it back in. Put it back in so that people know if they're going to walk out and just collapse the executive and the assembly, it's automatic direct rule. So there's it fixed. Why is that not right? Why could that not be right? Why do people not get representation? Because they're not getting representation here now, Stephen. Why should they not? I don't want direct rule. I'm a devolutionist.
Why would any nationalist party... that doesn't want direct rule, obviously. Yeah. Why would any nationalist party sign up to an agreement where the DUP, for example, could have this hanging over them, that if they don't get what they want, they could walk out and institute direct rule in Northern Ireland? Like, how is that a feasible alternative for you to suggest? Would you expect Sinn Féin to sign up to that?
Well, they did. They did in 1998. That was the system in 1998. We all signed up to it. It was only changed in 2006. That is the system all of the political parties signed up to in 1998. All we're saying is that sometimes we have to do a factory setting reset, and we need to go back to some of the things that we were doing. We have changed it with various different agreements, be that the Stormont House Agreement, be that the St Andrews Agreement, be that Fresh Start. And we have blurred the lines between power sharing and sharing out power.
Let's talk about Brexit.
Surely.
Shall we? Because you talk a lot about this in your manifesto, the Union of the United Kingdom ahead of the European Union. Now, your party campaigned to remain. Yeah. And then after the vote, you said you wanted to respect the result and you became a Brexit-supporting party. Was that the right decision or was that a mistake?
No, it was the right decision, Stephen. Let's
even given the fact that it's now threatened, in your view, the union?
3 years on now, you're absolutely right. So let's just talk about how complicated Brexit has become now, if I can. I know you're tight on time here, but we are now in the situation, because of circumstance, that some people who are absolutely opposed to Brexit would absolutely facilitate Boris Johnson's deal and create Brexit. And some people who want Brexit would stop Boris Johnson's deal and therefore thwart Brexit because of circumstances. That's just the way things have changed over the last 3 years. The US Unionist Party did support Remain because they thought there was a chance of damaging the union if we left. But it was democracy, and democracy said we were leaving. So we supported that democratic vote. That's the right thing to do. But 3 years
on... supported the democratic vote,
yes.
And therefore... part of that support, if you're right, has resulted in a threat to the union.
Yes, it has.
So maybe you shouldn't have supported that result.
Well,
put the union first, as your manifesto says you always okay, will. Didn't then.
Well, we supported democracy, Stephen, and we did not foresee. Did anybody foresee that 3 years on we would be in a situation now where we'd be sitting with Boris Johnson's deal, which absolutely carves Northern Ireland away from the rest of the United Kingdom and leave us a place apart? Did anybody foresee that? I certainly didn't foresee that. Did the party foresee that? No, the party did not foresee it. Did the DUP foresee it? I don't think they did. But that's where we are now. So we are now in the situation. This is the only situation we have at this moment in time. It's either Boris Johnson's deal or Remain. If it's Boris Johnson's deal or Remain, we have to remain. Because if we don't, it will absolutely damage our union.
But Boris Johnson has said that the whole of the UK will be leaving the EU, lock, stock and barrel.
Of course he will.
And there's the principle of consent built in to Northern Ireland, where we cannot be taken out of the UK without the consent principle. So how is the union endangered?
Stephen, we can revisit all of this, and you've done this on many, many occasions, and I think you're very good at it. You know, so I've no issue there. But the reality is that if Boris Johnson's deal goes through, there is a border down the Irish Sea for goods, a regulatory border, and Northern Ireland will stay under the jurisdiction of the European courts on many, many issues. We have to take a vote every 4 years. That means business cannot plan fiscally 5, 6, 7, or 8 years ahead. That's not good for business. So we cannot support that. And then if you link all of that, we will not have any say in any of this. It will be given to us by committee. So we can't support that, Steve.
Well, compared to Boris Johnson's deal, you say in your manifesto, in September this year, the Ulster Unionist Party set out a clear alternative to the Irish border backstop issue.
Yeah.
And you said our proposal included the creation of a new criminal offence for knowingly transporting non-compliant goods through the UK to the EU. Mm-hmm. A new body would have been established to monitor and regulate trade across the border.
Yes.
How?
Well,
And regulate it by what?
Well, it monitors
border posts.
Well, no, absolutely not, Stephen. I've stood on border posts. They're not going to work. They'll never work. They'll never
so
be
how
here.
How would you monitor and regulate something if you also want to be a criminal offence if they're caught?
Yes, if they're caught. So if you have any cross border bodies, and we have many cross border bodies that they have the ability to check data, to be able to visit locations, be able to visit companies, but visit anybody who is moving goods through Northern Ireland. You know, if you link that to things like the Trusted Trader Scheme, if you link it through to the Smart Borders 2.0, which was proposed by the Policy Department of Constitutional Affairs of the European Union.
But the Trusted Trader Scheme, the clue's in the title.
Yeah.
They are trusted traders.
Yeah, of course,
they're usually big established brand name companies
yes.
who have a track record of complying with the law.
That's correct.
So what you're talking about here is monitoring and regulating trade across the border with some entities that will not be trusted traders. So because you want a criminal offence.
If they knowingly break, absolutely.
And some of those people who will be knowingly breaking the law will be smugglers. They will not be trusted traders.
But smuggling is a police issue, Stephen. People keep saying this. Smuggling happens now. Smuggling happens today. As we're speaking, there's people smuggling. That is a justice police issue.
So would you monitor and regulate trusted traders?
Well, we will link into anybody who's doing continuous trade across
so
that border.
So how would you, what would your new ideas be to monitor and regulate?
Let me explain. So
non-trusted traders.
Well, just because they're a non-trusted trader doesn't mean they wouldn't be open to inspection. That doesn't mean
Where would that inspection happen?
Where would it happen?
Yeah.
At their premises.
Would that not impose extra cost on Northern Ireland businesses?
Well, I'm not so sure it would if they're regularly moving goods across the border, either north south or south north. Then they are ready for anybody coming in and saying, "Let me see your paperwork," and checking their paperwork. Where's the extra cost for that? Their paperwork should be up to speed in regards to that, and the vast majority of them absolutely will. So I don't see.
So these would be random checks.
They could be random checks. They could be checks which are forecast in advance. They could be 6-monthly checks.
Would you stop any lorries?
I don't think it would need to happen, Stephen. I think one of the big things is we cannot, in any shape or form, have anything which blocks the trade north, south, or east and west.
Okay.
And that's what we've been saying, is we don't want to do that. We don't want borders at all.
You say huge uncertainty remains as to how Northern Ireland would have any influence, this is in the context of Brexit, over the VAT regime we would fall within.
Yeah.
Would we not be falling within the UK VAT regime?
No, because there's a derogation on this where we will have to fall in part of the EU's VAT regime as well, and there's no clarity on how that is actually going to work. So we have a concern in regards to all of that. I mean, there's many of these things, Stephen, that's been put out there which don't have the detail that we need. So if we look at the large ticket items in regards to the Boris Johnson's deal, which we have a real concern with, and it is those issues about consent, it is those issues about a vote every 4 years. It is the regulatory border. It is a matter of having to do exit summaries and declarations coming from one jurisdiction to the other jurisdiction. All of these are a concern, and VAT is another concern.
You say if we can move on.
Surely.
Priorities for Ulster Unionist MPs re-imaging the union under that section.
Yes.
You say that you would ensure unionism does better in selling the many benefits of the union.
Yep.
Collectively, unionism must offer an open, tolerant and welcoming message that is able to both attract traditional support as well as appeal to new audiences.
Yes.
In terms of that traditional support of re-imaging the union, would you support an Irish Language Act?
I mean, this is a hugely emotive issue, Stephen, the Irish Language Act. So let me, and I hope your listeners believe me when I say this. So I think the Irish language absolutely enhances our identity and our culture. It needs to be respected. It needs to be funded. It needs to be promoted. And I really agree that. But I do not agree in an act, be that an Irish Language Act or an Ulster Scots Act. And here is the reason why. Because I think, not intentionally, but I think it could create further division here in Northern Ireland, because you could go down one road, for example, and you'll see street signs and services which are in English and Irish, and go down another road and you'll see street signs which are in English and Ulster Scots. And that is not deliberate, but it would create a division within our space. And I don't support that. And that concerns me, not immediately, but in 5 years' time or 10 years' time.
Have you looked at Sinn Féin's proposal in their manifesto for Irish language street signs?
I haven't seen it, if I'm perfectly honest with you, Steve.
Okay, so their proposal, and by the way, Sinn Féin are now telling us again that they are going to confirm today whether they're coming in to be interviewed. Like, how long does it take? Just decide, for goodness sake. Do you want to come in, sell your vision to people in Northern Ireland? Let me ask you questions about health and education and the environment that I'm doing with Doug, or not. And the same of the DUP. In terms of Sinn Féin, what they have said in terms of street signs, because I read their manifesto a couple of days ago, they have said that they would recommend a 50 plus one survey. So if in a particular area, if there was over 50% wanted the street signs in Irish, yeah, and that would happen. Is that not reasonable?
Well, that's, I think it's something very similar happens at council level for certain signs as well.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, it does alleviate the real concern I have, Stephen, and this is a real concern that I have about division. Now, you go to any post-conflict society and you look at how culture and language can divide as well as unite. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that this is going to divide people, but it can divide people as well as unite people. So if you take yourself, for example, to Bosnia-Herzegovina, a country split in half down cultural lines, language lines. So you've got one half, the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, the other half is the Republic of Srpska. Take yourself down to Mostar. Mostar has got two fire brigades. One speaks one language, the other speaks the other language. Now, I'm not saying, and that's an extreme, and I'm not saying that's going to happen in Northern Ireland, but that's an extreme where in 5, 10, 15 years' time, I don't want to go down there.
But you're saying an Irish Language Act could create division.
Yes, could.
An Irish Language Act has already created division. You're in a vacuum here, surely, in your thought process, because an Irish Language Act is one of the reasons, commentators would argue, that we don't have a government. Is your party not prepared to have an open mind to an Irish Language Act if it brought a government back to Northern Ireland?
Remember this.
Is it a red line?
Remember that we don't have any red lines.
So look, it's not a red line?
No, we can't and wouldn't block an Irish language. We can't physically do it. You know, and it wouldn't be one of our things.
Might you ever support an Irish Language Act?
No, I don't know. In 5 years, 10 years, 20...
No, now. We're testing you now.
No, Stephen, no.
But it's creating division, Doug.
Yes, and
what harm would it be giving other citizens in this country when you talk about attracting traditional support and re-imaging the union? Why not reach out to some of your nationalist neighbours?
So, Stephen, and I thought I explained it, but I'll try again. In the short and the medium term right now, our fear is, and it is a genuine fear, that it will create more division. And we have looked at post-conflict societies and we can see how it can do that. Now, just remember, under the Belfast Agreement, it was the Ulster Unionist Party who put things in place to be able to enhance the Irish language. The Irish language in Northern Ireland has grown under what we did in 1998. It is funded more because of what we did in 1998. So things are growing here in Northern Ireland under the status quo at this moment in time, based on what we did in 1998. You know, in the Irish Republic, the Irish language is dwindling, but here it is growing, and it's growing organically. It's growing organically.
And you welcome its growth?
Yeah, of course I welcome its growth. I have no issue with the language. I really genuinely welcome its growth. Look in East Belfast, where more and more people want to speak the Irish language. So I have no issue with the Irish language. And that's the problem, that people think just because I don't want an act, then I have an issue with the Irish language. And I'm trying to say to people, I genuinely do not. Okay. I class myself as Irish. I've always classed myself as Irish. I don't have an issue with it.
You talk in terms of the environment.
Yeah.
Your party says that you would want to make it mandatory for properties to meet a minimum EPC rating.
Yeah.
For all of us who currently own a home and our properties do not meet that rating, you would impose that burden on every householder in Northern Ireland to get their house fixed up to meet an EPC rating. By when?
Well, actually, I think what we're referring to, Stephen, is if you're going to be a landlord and you're going to rent your property out to people who are, and we have a real shortage of housing, but if you're going to rent out to people your property, then we reckon it should be at a certain EPC level.
Not referring to landlords. This is under your heading, Safe, Affordable and Sustainable Homes. Northern Ireland is simply not building enough houses, you say.
Yep.
This is not about landlords and renting. This is about homes for everyone. And you say you would seek to make it mandatory for properties with a reasonable expectation of habitation,
yes,
to meet a minimum EPC rating.
Yes.
So that would be mandatory. So if any house can be lived in, you're going to force us all, maybe rightly so, for it to have a minimum EPC rating. That means injecting the walls with presumably insulation and getting your house done up to meet this rating. What about those people that can't afford it?
Okay, Stephen, so I'll say to you again exactly what I just said to you now. We are talking about people who are landlords and people who are going into houses were...
That's not what your manifesto
says. A housing, where does it say anything different? It just says there that there's a housing crisis. There's a housing... Not everybody owns a house, Stephen. There's
no,
a housing,
but some of us do.
Yes, of course I do. I'm one of those people who own a house. But what we're saying is, for those people who are going to rent out their home to people, that that house should have a minimum EPC standard. I think that's a fair ask. Why is it not? So that people who are...
But you wouldn't require... Because you're talking this manifesto about new houses being built.
Yes, and many of those new
houses... So would they have to meet this EPC
rating? Well, all new houses that are built should meet an EPC standard.
Right.
But the point that we're making and the point we're trying to labour on here is if in the rental market, if a person is going into a house, vulnerable people who are going into a house should go into a house with an expectation that that house will be habitable. And to do that, we reckon there should be an EPC standard. I think it's a fair ask. I don't think there's anything majorly wrong with that at all.
Your manifesto doesn't say that it's just for rental
houses.
Well,
do you know what, Stephen... You know, words are words, but I'm saying to you now that what we're talking about.
I give the same chance to Stephen Farry,
yes.
Because I'm out of time. There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about. Why should people... I wonder if people are getting sick and tired in Northern Ireland of the politics of fear.
Yes.
Of that people don't vote for a politician based on what they can deliver for their life in terms of the issues we've talked about today, schools and hospitals and the environment, and instead they vote in the colour of a flag.
Yeah.
Why should people in this country trust your party that you're not going to just default back to a Union Jack?
Well, I'm
maybe they should, by the way.
I'm sitting here talking to you, Stephen, and I'm trying to be, during this interview, as honest as I possibly can. And I'm telling you now that we are a party that wants to respect and do respect every single person within our society.
Do you welcome gay marriage in Northern
Ireland? Absolutely, I do.
Same-sex marriage?
I do, yeah.
Does your party?
Well, it's a conscience issue, Stephen.
Conscience issue, so no policy?
It's conscience. You know, I can only tell you what the policy is, and that's a conscience issue. So
in other words, your party...
But I do.
You do,
yeah.
But your party doesn't.
Well, it's a conscience issue, and it will stay a conscience issue, Stephen. But let me give you a little tale, if I can, please. I was up a lamppost putting a poster up in 2007, and a man came up to me, and he looked, and he says, "Doug, is that you up there?" And I says, "Yes." He says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm running for election." He says, "Fantastic. You'll be a great man, a great MP for Upper Ban. You know, we need people like you, but I can't vote for you, because we need to keep Sinn Féin out." So you're absolutely right that people are voting over fear. And there is a moral lack of courage in many people, but it is a fear that's been ingrained within our society. I think it's truly awful, but that's the reality. But we are trying to say to people, we do respect everybody, absolutely everybody.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure, mate.